So happy Sabbath. It was a nice, kind of a nice drive-in. A little cold for me, but I'll make it. Welcome those who are tuned in online. So I will admit that my son was the impetus for the message that I wrote, because he sent me a video of somebody talking about the probabilities of the messianic prophecies being fulfilled, the way that they were fulfilled by Christ. And I thought it was fascinating, so I went and I looked up the book that was in this video, and it was written by Dr. Peter Stoner in 1958. So that goes back a ways. So my suspicion was at the time, is this still relevant, 1958 to today? Well, that begs the question, well, what was the research? So I kept reading. So let me read a couple of things here to give you some background. Dr. Stoner was chairman of the Departments of Mathematics and Astronomy at Pasadena City College until 1953. He was chairman of the Science Division, Westmont College, and through 1957, and he was professor emeritus of science, Westmont College, professor emeritus of mathematics and astronomy, Pasadena City College. So that's important, and just in terms of, if somebody's going to produce a scientifically based paper and they want to have that peer reviewed and they want to have that accepted by the community, it helps if you've got the chops, if you have the education, if you have the background to be able to produce said paper, or it can be dubious and may not even be accepted. This was accepted. His work was accepted. And so let me read from the foreword. The foreword to Dr. Stoner's book was written by H. Harold Hartzler, Ph.D., of the American Scientific Affiliation. He wrote, quote, "The Manuscript for Science," this is the title of the book, "Science Speaks." So the manuscript for Science Speaks has been carefully reviewed by a committee of the American Scientific Affiliation members and by the executive council of the same group, and has been found in general to be dependable and accurate in regard to the scientific material presented. The mathematical analysis included is based on principles of probability, which are thoroughly sound, and Professor Stoner has applied these principles in a proper and convincing way. What his book does is it evaluates several prophecies from the Old Testament, messianic prophecies. Now, his book actually evaluates more than messianic prophecies. He looks at a number of different fairly large prophecies, actually, and keep in mind this is the mid-1950s, and the research that had been done archaeologically, which were validating some things, have some of that, the community has sort of resisted that it's complete and total evidence, and so some of his work has been questioned in that regard or over more recent times. But the messianic work is still valid. There's nothing you can prove that's wrong with it. So the question is, why did he want to do this analysis? Well, keep in mind that he was a part of Pasadena City College, which is a Protestant college in Pasadena. So it's a religious school. And his concern, as he expressed it in his own writings about the time period, was that kids were going to college, and they going to college with faith, leaving college without. And he's like, why are we sending our kids to school so that they can be essentially brainwashed into believing that God doesn't exist? This was just irksome enough to him that he thought, if they just understood this one issue, like this issue of fulfilled prophecy, this should remove all doubt. There's not only did God inspire the written word called our Bible, but that he also ensured the fulfillment of prophecies that he put in that Bible. Like, don't you understand this, you young minds full of mush? So he set about to do this study, but he didn't do it alone. The study is really meant to subdue any speculation that Jesus Christ, or anyone else for that matter, could have manipulated events to ensure that he fulfilled prophecies about the Messiah to claim that he was the Messiah. Step back from the whole issue and just thinking about it from his perspective, where he wants to try to prove, essentially statistically using probability, application of probabilities, that it's impossible that God did not do all these things. But the skeptic might say, well, happenstance, luck, somebody being in the right place at the right time, that can account for some of that, surely. Maybe Christ manipulated things to make it look like he was the Messiah, after all. I mean, Christ is a historical figure. There isn't any doubt that he existed, that he walked on this earth. No one serious questions that. So then the question would be, if they acknowledge that he existed, but still don't want to believe that he is the Messiah, how would you come to that conclusion? Well, the critic might say, well, he probably just manipulated things. So with that sort of question in the background, Dr. Stoner's group, so keep in mind that he was teaching at the time, and so he had many classes that he involved in this project. In fact, well over 600 students. Let me read from the foreword here from this. It says, the Inter-Varsity Christian Fellowship at Pasadena City College sponsored a class in Christian evidences. One section of the work of this class was to consider the evidence produced by the fulfilled prophecies referring to the first advent of Christ. The students were asked to be very conservative in their probability estimates. They discussed each prophecy at length, bringing out various conditions which might affect the probability of any man fulfilling it. After discussion, the students agreed unanimously on a definite estimate as being both reasonable and conservative. At the end of the evaluations, the students expressed their feelings thus: if anyone were able to enter into discussions and help in placing the estimates as they had done, that person would certainly agree that the estimates were conservative. The estimates used in this chapter are a combination of the estimates given by this class on Christian evidences combined with estimates given me later by some 12 different classes of college students representing more than 600 students. I have carefully weighed the estimates and have changed some to make them more conservative. Okay, what he's essentially saying is, what I intend to present to you, I want it to be so absolutely conservative that no one could look at the work and say, you embellished those numbers to make it look better than it actually was. He made it look worst case scenario by constantly reducing probabilities that should have been higher in unlikeliness, if I can say that way. Meaning, he was very conservative in his numbers. Not liberal, not embellishing, but very, very, very conservative. And what they did was they took just eight messianic prophecies, and then they evaluated the probability that any one man could have fulfilled one of those eight. And so they'll look at each one of them individually. And we're going to look at those same eight to see that God prophesied something about the Messiah. God fulfilled that prophecy. And then we're going to talk about the probability. If that's not God, what was the probability that anyone else could do it? That's what we're going to look at today. The first prophecy that they looked at is that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. And over in Micah chapter 5 and verse 2, so Micah chapter 5 and verse 2, we have this prophecy given to us in Scripture, in the Old Testament. It says here in verse 2, but you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from old, from everlasting. Messianic prophecy that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. Okay? Evidence of that happening from the testimony of Matthew. In Matthew chapter 2, Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 6. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they said to him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. So we have a prophecy. We have Jesus Christ fulfilling that prophecy. He was born in Bethlehem. First question I ask myself, how do you make yourself be born somewhere? I didn't have any say in that deal. I was born in Santa Rosa. I would have preferred to be born in Vancouver, Mom. But I was born in Santa Rosa. So you don't really have any control over that one, right? So that makes that kind of an interesting probability question. What is the likelihood that someone could make something like that happen just to fulfill the prophecy? Well, they ignore the part that you don't have choice to do the analysis. Keep in mind this also, that Micah was written by the prophet sometime between 730 and 750 BC. He was a contemporary of Isaiah. All right? So over 700 years before the Messiah is born, this prophecy of where he would be born is given. And then it is fulfilled to the letter. Okay, so the question is, one man in how many men the world... This is, comes directly out of Dr. Stoner's book. This is his question. The question is, one man in how many men the world over has been born in Bethlehem? I mean, set aside that this was a very specific prophecy about the Messiah being born there, what's the probability that anyone would be born there? So they did an analysis of this, and here's what he says. Quote, "The best estimate which we can make of this comes from the attempt to find out the average population of Bethlehem from Micah down through the present time and divide it by the average population of the earth during the same period. One member of the class was an assistant in the library, so he was assigned to get this information. He reported at the next meeting that the best determination of the ratio that he could determine was 1 in 280,000. So one person in 280,000 would have or could have been born in Bethlehem, that alone fulfilling the prophecy, aside from him being the Messiah. So we begin with that, fairly high probability. 1 in 280,000, low probability. Not super low, but low. Okay, but consider, of course, that this was predicted 700 years later than the person who wrote the prophecy. And it was fulfilled. What are the chances? The second prophecy that the group looked at, a messenger would be sent ahead of the Messiah to prepare for his coming. Malachi chapter 3 and verse 1, we have the prophecy of a messenger going before the Messiah. Malachi chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, "Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight. Behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts." Now, add to that Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 3. It says, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God." Okay, so this is the two combined prophecies, which basically say the same thing. There is a messenger that's going to go before the Messiah, and he's going to be preparing the way for the Messiah. We would call that a forerunner. And so let's go over here to Mark chapter 1 to see its fulfillment. Mark chapter 1, verses 2 through 8. Beginning in verse 2, "As it is written in the prophets, behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight." Quoting the prophecy and in its fulfillment, John came baptizing in the wilderness and preaching a baptism of repentance for the remission of sins. Then all the land of Judea and those from Jerusalem went out to him and were all baptized by him in the Jordan River, confessing their sins. Now, John was clothed with camel's hair and with a leather belt around his waist, and he ate locusts and wild honey, and he preached, saying, "There comes one after me who is mightier than I, whose sandal strap I am not worthy to stoop down and loose. I indeed baptize you with water, but he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit." A messenger preceding the Messiah, fulfilled exactly as the prophecy said, preparing the way for Jesus Christ. So now we have two prophets who were not contemporary with one another. Isaiah was a contemporary with Micah, as I said earlier. His book was written in around the mid-700s B.C., or about 700 years before Christ. But Malachi was the last prophet of the Old Testament. He was a contemporary with Ezra and Nehemiah. So he would have written his epistle or his letter right around, that prophecy would have been given right around the mid-400s B.C., so 300 years after Isaiah, Malachi is prophesying a similar prophecy about the Messiah. Neither one of them knew each other or lived anywhere near one another in time. And yet they both prophesied about the same event. Okay, so we have a prerequisite to our second prophecy that must be met in our statistical analysis. The question now is, of the men that have been born in Bethlehem, one in how many has had a forerunner to prepare his way? This is what Dr. Stoner writes. John the Baptist, of course, was the forerunner of Christ. But since there appears to be no material difference between the people born in Bethlehem and those born in any other place in the world, the question can just as well be general. One man in how many, the world over, has had a forerunner to prepare his way? Like, I'm trying, you know, all of these things. I have gone through this exercise of trying to think in my mind, like in a modern context, what does this look like? I don't know. Honestly, there's not really a good corollary for this. Like, do you need someone to go before you to announce that you're coming for some important reason? Like, maybe, probably not. You'd just call yourself, wouldn't you? I'm coming. Anyway, think about that. Here's the answer. It says, the student said that the prophecy apparently referred to a special messenger of God whose one duty was to prepare the way for the work of Christ. So there is a further restriction added. The students finally agreed on one in 1,000 as being extremely conservative. Most of the members thought the estimate should be much larger. Okay, so he's saying that the students settled on one person in 1,000, having had someone go before them to prepare the way for their future work of somebody born in Bethlehem, coming to Jerusalem, preparing the way for it. Okay. Two people who lived 300 years apart both prophesied that the Messiah would have a forerunner go before him to prepare the way for his ministry. What are the chances? The third prophecy. The Messiah would enter Jerusalem on a donkey. That comes from Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 9 and verse 9. So Zechariah 9 verse 9 says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey." Okay, let's turn over to Matthew's testimony in Matthew chapter 21 to see its fulfillment. Matthew chapter 21, beginning in verse 1, and we'll read through verse 11. Verse 1 says, "Now when they drew near Jerusalem and came to Bethphage at the Mount of Olives, then Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, 'Go into the village opposite you, and immediately you will find a donkey tied and a colt with her. Loose them and bring them to me. And if anyone says anything to you, you shall say, the Lord has need of them, and immediately he will send them.' All this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, saying, Tell the daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming to you. Is coming to you lowly and sitting on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey. So the disciples went and did as Jesus commanded. They brought the donkey and the colt, laid their clothes on them, and set him on them. And a very great multitude spread their clothes on the road. Others cut down branches from the trees and spread them on the road. Then the multitudes who went before and those who followed cried out, saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, Hosanna in the highest. And when he had come into Jerusalem, all the city was moved, saying, Who is this? So the multitude said, This is Jesus, the prophet from Nazareth of Galilee. Christ fulfilling this prophecy. Now Zechariah wrote this prophecy during the time of Zerubbabel, who was governor of Judea. So when Judah was allowed to come back out of captivity in Babylon to return back to Jerusalem, Zerubbabel was appointed the governor at that time. This would have been around 538 BC. Zechariah is writing during this window of time before the temple is completed, which is around 517, because the people's interest waned. They were being persecuted by the Samaritans at the time as well. So there was plenty of reason for them to maybe not be as enthusiastic as they should have been, and God certainly chastised them through Zechariah and Haggai, who were writing at that time period. So that gives you the time frame. So right around the early 500s BC, so nearly 500 years before this happens, it's prophesied by this, you know, sort of obscure prophet about Jesus Christ, the Messiah. Our question then is, says Dr. Stoner, one man in how many who was born in Bethlehem and had a forerunner did enter Jerusalem as a king riding on a colt, the foal of a donkey? This becomes so restrictive. He's saying this and he's right. This is so absolutely restrictive. We're going to have to change this up a little bit. This becomes so restrictive that we should consider an equivalent question. One man in how many who has entered Jerusalem as a ruler has entered riding on a colt, the foal of a donkey? The student said that this was a very hard thing to place an estimate on. I wonder why. They knew of no one but Christ who had so entered. The students thought that at least in more modern times, anyone entering Jerusalem as a king would use a more dignified means of transportation, like a limousine or something, right? I mean, who today would plot to ride into Jerusalem as some kind of ruler on a donkey? You would probably wouldn't get the kind of respect you would hope for. But anyway, so the students thought that at least in more modern times, anyone entering would do so in a more dignified means of transportation. They agreed to place an estimate of 1 in 10,000. 1 in 10,000. But Dr. Stoner is dissatisfied with that. He changes it to 1 in 100. 1 in 100. Who could have done this? Okay, hang on. I want you to think about this. How many people live in Canby? I'm not going to ask Mrs. Scruggs. She probably has no idea. 18,000. A little over 18,000. Okay, let's use that. It's about twice the size of Bethlehem at the time of Christ. So let's use that. 1 in 100 entered Portland as a ruler on a donkey. That would be 180 people. And all 180 had a forerunner who went before them into Portland to say, somebody's coming, he's important. 180 people, really? That's how conservative that estimate is. Do you believe that? Can you in any way picture that being in any way, shape, or form realistic? No. Makes my head itch a little bit on the inside thinking about it. Okay. Now add to that someone over 500 years ago accurately predicted it to happen. 180 people coming out of Canby going into Portland with a forerunner on a donkey. Okay, just putting it in your mind. What are the chances? Number 4, the Messiah would be betrayed by a friend, resulting in his hands being wounded. Back to Zechariah. Now Zechariah 13 and verse 6. Verse 6 says, and one will say to him, what are these wounds between your arms? Now, that's the New King James. The King James Version says, in the hands. Okay? And one shall say to him, what are these wounds in thine hands? From the King James Version. Then he shall answer, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. Okay? Psalm 41, verse 9. Okay, Psalms 41 and verse 9 says, even my own familiar friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. So this just confirms that whoever betrays the Messiah would be considered a friend, and that the result of the betrayal would be that the Messiah's hands would be wounded. Now that's pretty specific, you know, because I Googled that. Like, it's so absurd to think about that in modern context. I thought, well, has it ever happened, though? Maybe just by chance it's a news story someplace. I searched and searched and searched. How many stories like that do you think I came across? Precisely zero. So the odds of this happening in any context, I mean, think about betrayal. That's a very personal thing. Do you feel betrayed by an enemy? Hardly. You feel betrayed by somebody that you know, love, and respect generally. If they betray you, then that's something that you feel. And so that's why this would be something very specific to try to figure out what the probability of somebody being able to make this happen. Very, very difficult. So it's fulfillment. Over here, we'll go to a couple of different places here to fulfill this. Luke chapter 22. I will admit that some prophecies blend into others very quickly because they're all connected in some very specific ways. But this is still a separate prophecy regarding Christ in the connection between the betrayer being a friend and then his betrayal leading to an injury to the hands specifically. Okay, so Luke 22, verse 3, where we just have it confirmed. Then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. So we know the betrayer was among the 12. We already know that, but in terms of just satisfying proof, we cover that. Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26, verse 47 through 50. And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude, with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, whomever I kiss, he is the one, seize him. Immediately he went up to Jesus and said, greetings, Rabbi, and kissed him. But Jesus said to him, friend, why have you come? Okay, so we remove all doubt that Christ did consider Judas a friend in the context here. Now, turn over to John chapter 20 to read the other element that the betrayer would lead to Christ's hands being wounded. John chapter 20, beginning in verse 24. We'll read through 27. Now Thomas, called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. That's referring to the Sunday as Christ had ascended and then came back down from the Father, having presented himself as the wave sheaf. He comes back down and manifests himself to many people on that day, disciples in particular, except Thomas wasn't there to have witnessed this. The other disciples therefore said to him, we have seen the Lord. So he said to them, unless I see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. And after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas with them. Jesus came, and the doors being shut, and stood in the midst and said, peace to you. Then he said to Thomas, reach your finger here, and look at my hands. And reach your hand in here, and put it in to my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. Okay, so prophecy, it's fulfillment. He was supposed to be betrayed. That would lead to wounding of his hands. Here, Thomas gets to personally witness and stick his fingers in the holes in Christ's hands. What's a couple things to think about here. So Psalm 41 was written around, or in very rough numbers, 1000 BC by King David. So that's over 1,000 years before the birth of the Messiah. David's prophecy focuses on being betrayed by a friend, and that the result would be that the Messiah would be harmed. Zechariah was written 500 years before the birth of the Messiah and 500 years after David. But his prophecy was more specific because it indicated that the harm would come to the Messiah's hands as a result of the betrayal. And these two men who lived 500 years apart both prophesied about this issue. Okay, here's what the book says. Here's what Dr. Stoner says. He says, there seems to be no relation between the fulfillment of this prophecy and those which we have previously considered. We may then ask the question, one man in how many, the world over, has been betrayed by a friend, and that betrayal has resulted in his being wounded in his hands? Well, I told you, I couldn't find a single news story in all of Googledom, whatever that means. The student said that it was very rare to be betrayed by a friend, and still rarer for the betrayal to involve wounding in the hands. One in 1,000 was finally agreed upon, though most of the students would have preferred a larger number. Really? Like the odds should be better than that, or far worse than that? The chance is so much more remote than that. And it's very specific. Someone 500 years before prophesied that the Messiah would be betrayed by a friend and that as a result his hands would be wounded. What are the chances? Okay, number five. The Messiah would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. Back in Zechariah, here we're in Zechariah chapter 11 and verse 12. Then I said to them, if it is agreeable to you, give me my wages, and if not, refrain. So they weighed out for my wages 30 pieces of silver. Okay, that's a fairly specific number. It's not 30-ish. It's not approximately 30. It's 30. Its fulfillment, Matthew chapter 26 again. In verse 14 and 15. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you? And they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver. Now, why this is important in particular is you have to think about this. Did the Jews want Christ to be the Messiah? No. I mean, that was their whole objection. You are not the Messiah. Here's a prophecy in Zechariah that the Messiah would be betrayed by someone who was paid 30 pieces of silver. Do you think they didn't know that? They had the scriptures. This is the chief priests. They have the scriptures. They know that this is in there. So they either didn't remember, forgot, or something, because here they are counting out 30 pieces of silver, the exact price that Zechariah said would be paid for the betrayer, or to the betrayer, for turning over the Messiah. So do you, like, a skeptic would say, what? That's just coincidence? That's a remarkable coincidence, if it is. So 500 years before it happened, Zechariah prophesied that the Messiah would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. And that's exactly what happened. Here is the analysis. The question here is very simple. Of the people who have been betrayed, one in how many has been betrayed for exactly 30 pieces of silver? The students thought this would be extremely rare and set their estimate as 1 in 10,000. Dr. Stoner, being very conservative, changed that. We will use 1 in 1,000. Those odds would be the same as 18 random people from Canby having been betrayed by a friend for the exact same amount of money, the value of which was determined 500 years ago. That's the odds. What are the chances? Prophecy number 6. The price of betrayal would be thrown down and used to buy a potter's field. You know, in terms of the analysis, the reason that he separated these two is because it makes it more of a conservative view. Because these were all done together. It's all relating to the betrayal, the price of betrayal, and what happened afterwards. But yet they chose to treat them as separate prophecies being fulfilled because they are components distinct from one another. Back to Zechariah 11, and now in verse 13. Zechariah 11:13, and the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that princely price they set on me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord for the potter. Its fulfillment back in Matthew, this time in Matthew chapter 27. We'll read verses 3 through 10, Matthew 27, 3 through 10. Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? You see to it. Then he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. Okay, so even if the skeptic said, look, maybe they worked together on this thing, well, then why did he hang himself? If everything went to plan, why did he hang himself? So that's unlikely. Verse 6, but the chief priests took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful to put them into the treasury because they are the price of blood. And they consulted together, without their Bible apparently, they consulted together and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the value of him who was priced, whom they of the children of Israel priced, and gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me. Okay. Now, this obviously is extremely specific. If you think about the elements of this prophecy, how somebody could possibly make this happen, it would be, in my mind, virtually impossible to make this happen. Dr. Stoner summarizes it this way. He says, our question is, one man in how many, after receiving a bribe for the betrayal of a friend, had returned the money, had it refused, had thrown it on the floor of the house of the Lord, and then had it used to purchase a field from the potter? The student said they doubted if there ever was any... Let me read this again. The student said they doubted if there has ever been another incident involving all of these items, but they agreed on an estimate of 1 in 100,000. They were very sure that this was conservative. Yeah, that's very conservative. I'll give them that. Because you have to think about how very specific and impossible this prophecy would be to fulfill. How do you negotiate a bribe to betray an innocent person? Then after changing your mind, you go back to the payee to return the money. They reject taking it back. Then you throw the money on the floor. And finally, they decide to buy a piece of land with the money, the amount of which matched the value of the bribe. And all of that was prophesied 500 years ago. What are the chances? Number 7. The Messiah would keep silent during his trial. Isaiah 53 gives us this prophecy. Isaiah 53 and verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Okay, its fulfillment is found in Matthew 26. Well, we're using Matthew 26 to see Matthew's testimony about its fulfillment. So, okay, Matthew 26, verses 62 and 63. And the high priest arose and said to him, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" So here he is in his trial. Men have been lying about him. False testimony is given. And throughout all the accusation stage, Christ does not respond. But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, "I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." And of course, Jesus said to him, "It is as you say. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." So Christ, during his trial, is falsely accused. False testimony is given about him, and he says nothing. He does not defend himself, just exactly as Isaiah had prophesied. Prophecy again and its fulfillment. It's kind of hard to imagine how you would arrange to have yourself arrested for something you didn't do, have a prosecuting attorney suborn perjury against you simply to get you convicted of this crime, and then you do not put on a defense for yourself? Like, the whole thing is lunacy. No way. I just can't envision this. The statistical analysis by Dr. Stoner says, one man and how many, after fulfilling the above prophecies, when he is oppressed and afflicted and is on trial for his life, though innocent, will make no defense for himself. Again, my students said they did not know that this had ever happened, and in any case, or in any case other than Christ, at least it is extremely rare, so they place their estimate at 1 in 10,000. Dr. Stoner says we will use 1 in 1,000. Again, we're knocking the numbers down. We're making the probabilities more probable than they should be. Like, it's laughably low probability, or laughably high probability, I guess. So 500 years before, someone predicted that the Messiah would be accused falsely and, though innocent, would not defend himself but would accept his fate quietly. Like, what are the chances? Number 8, the final prophecy that we will look at, that the book looked at, is that the Messiah would be crucified. Psalms chapter 22. Psalms chapter 22 and verse 16 says, "For dogs have surrounded me, the congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet." Okay, that's very specific. John chapter 19, we'll read its fulfillment. And we understand its fulfillment in multiple ways, but here we'll just read this one. John 19, verses 16 through 18. Then he delivered him to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus and led him away. And he, bearing his cross, went out to a place called the Place of a Skull, which is in Hebrew Golgotha, where they crucified him and two others with him, one on either side, and Jesus in the center. Okay, so that alone doesn't say what happened, but we know through historical evidence that crucifixion involved taking someone and staking their hands together above them and staking their feet below them to a pole. That's very specific to the process of crucifixion as a form of corporal punishment. Now, the psalm by David was written around 1000 BC, but the first generally accepted evidence of the use of crucifixion was by the Persians around the 6th century BC. And they did it because they thought that evil sinners being buried in the ground would desecrate the ground, so they buried them, they hung them above the ground when they killed them or punished them with death. David would have had no way of knowing what any of that meant. That happened 400 years after he died, when crucifixion was invented. So the likelihood that he could have accurately predicted this is so remote as to be ludicrous. But nevertheless, we have that prophecy. Now here, according to the book, he says the Jews are still looking for the coming of Christ. In fact, he might have come any time after these prophecies were written up to the present time, or even on into the future. So our question is, one man in how many from the time of David has been crucified? After studying the methods of execution down through the ages and their frequency, the students agreed to estimate this probability at 1 in 10,000, which we will use. So over 1,000 years earlier, 400 years before the methodology was even invented, someone prophesied that the Messiah would be killed in a way that did not exist at the time. What are the chances? Overall analysis. I hope this works. Am I on? Do I have to hit power? Okay, thank you, Karen. The analysis so far has been about assigning probabilities of fulfillment of each of these eight prophecies as much as possible, independent from one another. Okay? That is, the probability that any one man could have fulfilled any of these eight prophecies, and each of those were looked at individually. Now, before I go into this, this has been the big challenge of this presentation, is how do we, in any way, shape, or form, get our minds around the probabilities that we're going to look at. They are so astronomically large against someone being able to do this without God's direct intervention. So I started thinking about long odds, just to give us a framework about what odds look like, things that we might be familiar with, okay? Getting hit by lightning, your chances are 1 in 1,000,000. If you live in the South, certain parts of the country, it's like 1 in 500,000, so better odds, but still not great. I don't know of anybody who's ever been struck by lightning. Winning the lottery, the Powerball, the big one. You know, the one that we always see these really large numbers now. $900 million Powerball, and everybody wants to get one. 1 in 292 million is the odds of winning that. Way worse than that if you don't buy a ticket. I think it's impossible, but I'm pretty sure it's impossible if you don't actually buy a ticket. Okay. I was looking for other things with even longer odds. So I looked up, I love chat, these AIs for chat, like ChatGPT and Copilot and Gemini, because you can ask them absurd questions and they come up with answers. I said, give me the top three things most unlikely to happen to a human being. One of them was a meteorite lands in your backyard. Like, what are the odds? Well, that's 3, 6, 9, 12, 13 zeros. So you can rest assured in your lifetime, a meteor is not going to land in your backyard. Or its chances of being so is 1 in 20 trillion. Okay? That's why I call those long odds. So you get a sense of what I mean by long odds. Like, are you going to go build some sort of a structure in your backyard now to prevent a meteorite from landing in it because you're so afraid that a meteorite could with these odds? So you're saying there's a chance. Not a good one. Okay, so I at least wanted you to have these in your mind as we start talking about the odds of fulfilling, of one man fulfilling all eight of those prophecies. Just one man. All eight. The answer is, it's one in one followed by 17 zeros. That one man, somehow on their own, could have fulfilled all eight prophecies. A one followed by 17 zeros. Just to be more clear about this, the fact that God did it, God gets the one and the 17 zeros. Satan, chance, anyone else but God, they get the one. Okay? That's how unlikely it would be that anyone could do this except for God. Now, how big a number is a 1 followed by 17 zeros? Here's the chances that any one person could have made this happen except God. If I took a silver dollar, okay, so we talked about probability. So here, let's look at this in the more, how do you practically look at probability? If I have a hat or a cup or a bowl, and I have silver dollars, I mark one silver dollar and I put 10, so there's 1 and 10 in there, and I walk over to you, I blindfold you, and say, stick your hand in there and pull out the marked one. What are your chances? 1 in 10, correct? There's 10 in there, and there's only one marked. You got a 1 in 10 chance. So we're talking about odds. So thinking about that same silver dollar, if I had a 1 followed by 17 zeros worth of silver dollars, and I covered the entire face of Oregon, the whole surface of Oregon, the entire state, I mean from Washington to California, from Idaho to the coast, every square inch has got silver dollars on it, you would have 4 feet deep in silver dollars. Okay? Now, I put a blindfold on you, and I tell you to walk in any direction that you want to walk for, as long as you want to walk, and when you stop, reach down into that pile someplace and pull out the marked silver dollar. That's the chances that a man could have done it. The one followed by 17 zeros is the chances that God did it. Okay? I hope that makes a little bit more sense to you. Because it is virtually impossible that God didn't do it. You know, let's say that I did you a favor. We took the blindfold off and I said, walk any direction you want to, study every single coin until you find the one marked out of one followed by 17 zeros worth of silver dollars. Do you know how long it would take you to find that silver dollar? Do you know how old the universe is? It's estimated to be 13.8 billion years old. It would take you longer than that to find that marked silver dollar, if you could see, to search for it. If that doesn't say impossible to you, we've just talked about 8. Do you know how many prophecies there are? Messianic prophecies that Christ fulfilled? Over 300, says Alfred Edersheim, a scholar who has studied this. Over 300 prophecies. The probability that one man on his own in any way, shape, or form could have fulfilled even 8 is that number. It's your chances of going out and finding on the face of Oregon one followed by 17 zeros worth of silver dollars. It is virtually impossible. But Dr. Stoner's group, being as conservative as they were, decided to see, well, what would the math look like if we fulfill 16 prophecies? Just 16 out of over 300 that Christ fulfilled. It is a 1 followed by 45 zeros. That is 45 zeros. It's kind of small, isn't it? Because, you know, I had to try to fit it on the screen. Like 45 zeros is a huge, huge, huge number. So I was going into the AIs, asking each of them independently, just to cross-check each other. So I asked Google's, I asked Microsoft's, and I asked ChatGPT, how big is 1 followed by 45 zeros? Well, at first they didn't want to answer because it's a ludicrously large number. So when I started asking them basic questions, they answered. Kind of funny. How deep would the pile of silver dollars be on the face of Oregon? And, you know, I mean, short of laughing at the idea, no, it's not possible. You can't even cover. There's too many to cover the state of Oregon. Okay, well then cover the United States. Too tiny. Cover the whole world. Way too small. Take every planet in the solar system and cover it in silver dollars, and how deep would they be? Infinitesimally too small. Add the sun? Not even close. Okay, if we had a sphere of silver dollars and we wrapped our solar system in that sphere, how large would this sphere be? 398 times larger than our solar system. So climb in my spaceship, will fly around that sphere any direction you want to go for as long as you want to fly. When you say stop, you get out in your space suit and you pick up the one marked silver dollar. Because God gets the 45 zeros and Satan, chance, they all get the one. How impossible is it that God did not do this? That God did not inspire the writing of the prophecy and also the fulfillment to the letter? It's impossible that he didn't do that. There isn't any room for a skeptic to say, well, I'm not sure that I believe that whole Christ is the Messiah thing. It's impossible that he's not. Unless you like those kinds of odds for virtually anything. I wondered what that would look like. I wonder what it looks like for you. Okay, the odds of 48 prophecies being fulfilled. That's a 1 followed by 157 zeros. Yes, there are 157 zeros on the screen right there. That number is so big that it was very difficult to get any of the AIs to give me any way in which human beings could conceive of the number. So I'm not going to try to do that. It would have all of you crying, I think, trying to process it. It's too overwhelming. And so this is just 48. Get out to 300. I don't know what that number is. We don't have enough room on any screen I can think of for the zeros. And God gets every single one of those zeros. Chance, luck, Satan, one. So as we start to head into Passover, we get into the days of unleavened bread, we start thinking about our Messiah, what he did, and he sacrificed himself for us. It's maybe important for us to realize he is our Messiah, that it's absolutely impossible that he's not. It is absolutely impossible that God did not write the Bible by his inspiration, that he did not inspire every single prophecy about the Messiah, and that he did not fulfill, personally ensure that they were fulfilled to every detail. This should give us the deep comfort that we understand there is a God. We understand there's a Messiah, and we understand how magnificent they are.